Adam told Kelly once STT was completed. I love the guys, the brotherhood, and I just love being a SEAL. Thank the Lord for putting me on this path. Kelly, too, had grown in her role as a mother. What had once sent her running out of a store in tears was no longer a big deal after 9 months of on-the-job training. Instead of abandoning her cart of groceries, she had learned a trick of the motherhood trade. Request an employee to park the cart in the walk-in refrigerator behind the milk and dairy department while she went to the car and fed Nathan. Representatives from all of Team 4's platoons assembled on the sand at Virginia Beach 1 week later to watch the remaining 20 graduates of STT pair up and make their way out through the rough seas for the Trident swim. I'll never forget that day because the surf was horrible, says Christian. Big waves and swell lines out to the horizon. We had to swim a half mile out to get beyond the breakers before we began the 3.5 mile swim up the coast. A couple dozen SEALs swam with them, but they wore shorts and t-shirts, maybe a wetsuit vest, while the new guys wore camis and dragged along a sledgehammer and a rucksack stuffed with clothes. Says Christian, our strongest swimmer carried the hammer the whole way. The rest of us switched off dragging the rucksack in groups of two. And that thing, when it was wet, was like a lead weight. They were also accompanied by the commander of Naval Special Warfare Group 2, as well as the commanding officer of Team 4, Captain Pete Van Hooser. Both men were widely respected. Van Hooser had served multiple tours as a Marine in Vietnam, then laterally transferred into the Navy and went through the SEAL program. In a parachuting accident, he suffered a compound fracture, shattering his leg so badly that he was told he'd never walk normally, much less run again, if he kept it. Van Hooser chose to have the leg amputated so he might function at the level he wanted and continue his career. Wearing a prosthetic, he joined his men for their hardest workouts, the monster mashes, grueling combinations of back-to-back runs, swims, and paddles. On the Trident swim with Adam and his teammates, his prosthetic was fitted with a fin so he could swim alongside. Janice and Larry had flown out from Hot Springs and stood with Kelly and Nathan and dozens of other supporters on the beach near the finish line. All smiles, the men exited the water and gathered in the shallows until everyone had finished. It had been a 2-year journey from the day Adam checked in at boot camp until he stood at attention in the surf on the Virginia Beach shore facing Captain Van Hooser as he took the backing off the pushpin of the gold trident. He pushed the trident through the fabric above the upper left pocket of Adam's soaking wet cami top, and a U.S. Navy SEAL was born. On paper, anyway. The rite of passage for a new SEAL involved one more initiation ceremony for full induction into this fraternity of warriors. An unofficial one. The night after the Trident swim, the newly pinned SEALs were invited to an off-the-record party, attendance not optional, at a Team 4 member's house. The new guys were called in pairs to the garage and directed to stand with their backs against the wall. This was the real pinning, says the SEAL who stood next to Adam as they handed over their tridents to a senior enlisted SEAL and removed their shirts. He pulled off the frogs, the pin backing, pushed the pins into our chests so they stuck, and punched them in with his fist. A line of at least a dozen Team 4 SEALs followed suit. One by one, they punched the tridents into our chests. It was hardcore. We were yelling and screaming. Not screams of pain. Screams of pride. All of our chests were bloody. And when we left that party, the ceremony was complete. We finally had credibility. We'd bled together. Now we could fight together. We were brothers. Chapter 11. The Calling. Picture a 1-year-old flying through the air, arms and legs flailing like an airborne cat. That was Nathan re-entering Earth's atmosphere after Adam had tossed him into orbit.
"Don't throw him so high," Kelly said.
"Oh, he loves it," said Adam. "Look at him, he's laughing."
"He's laughing because he's petrified. It's a nervous laugh. It is not. Kids don't know nervous.
Well, I'm petrified, pleaded Kelly. Please just...
Adam sent Nathan sailing again, caught him, then walked over to Kelly and gave her a hug and squeezed her nose.
Have I ever dropped him? He said.
No, I have not. I will not drop our baby.
It was January 26th, 2001, and Adam and Kelly's closest friends in Virginia Beach were at their apartment to celebrate Nathan's first birthday. Says Austin, I was more comfortable handling explosives. No kidding. Nothing made me more nervous than watching Adam throw Nathan in the air. Paul was also there with Heidi, now his wife, and Christian and Becky had brought along their baby boy. It was fortunate that their training cycle allowed them to be in Virginia Beach on Nathan's birthday. For the nearly 5 months since the men had earned their tridents, they'd been training with their newly assigned platoons. Golf platoon for Adam and Paul, and hotel platoon for Christian and Austin. These sister platoons trained and deployed together as a single task unit, one of six such units on SEAL Team 4. As Golf Platoon's 60 gunner, Adam single-handedly carried the Vietnam-era M60 machine gun, the heaviest weapon on a patrol. In every other unit in the military, the M60 is crew-serviced. One man shoulders the 23-pound gun and 100 rounds of ammo, weighing about 7 pounds, and a second man takes 400 rounds of ammo, about 28 pounds. On SEAL teams, one man, in this case Adam, handles it all solo. Almost 60 pounds of weapon and ammo, in addition to the rest of his equipment, altogether a total of 80 and often 90 pounds. The only other man in a SEAL platoon whose load rivals the 60 gunners is the radio man, Christian's job on a hotel platoon. Though these back-breaking jobs aren't desirable and are routinely assigned to the new guys, Adam and Christian took pride in them, arguing over whose load was the heaviest.
They would go on and on with their man talk, says Kelly, and they spoke a different language now. It took a while for us girls to catch on. The acronyms and calibers and cliques, we'd just laugh at them. These big, tough Navy SEALs talking the talk while drinking fruit punch in tiny paper cups, holding their babies and wearing Blue's Clues party hats. We were all pretty naive and innocent back then. We were young military couples just starting to have kids. We knew what our husbands did, what they were trained for, but it was peacetime. In my mind, it was like what they did was in a movie. What they were training for would never really happen.
36-year-old Shane Harley, Golf Platoon's chief, had served 10 years at the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, DEVGRU, before taking over a platoon at Team 4. Even the new guys knew what this meant. He'd been a Tier 1 operator with SEAL Team 6. On paper, the men who serve at DEVGRU test weapons and equipment being considered for Navy-wide implementation. Indeed, they are the Navy's weapons experts. But that is only the cover story. DEVGRU SEALs are also one of the United States' premier special missions units, capable of executing top-secret missions anywhere in the world. This was the rapidly deployable, highly elite counterterrorism unit the Navy had created as a result of the failed hostage rescue mission in Iran in 1980, when Adam was 6 years old. DEVGRU operators take orders from the highest levels within the Pentagon or directly from the Oval Office. Chief Harley was the only member of Golf Platoon who had seen action, and even though the details of that action were classified, he was revered by the men because only a tiny percentage of SEALs are chosen for DEVGRU. First, a SEAL has to be recommended by his commanding officer. Then his mental health and past are meticulously scrutinized for top-secret clearance. Finally, he is given a chance to qualify through a process that, according to those who have passed it, makes buds look like a cakewalk. As Team 4 SEALs, the guys on golf and hotel platoons already represented the alpha males of the U.S. Navy. But compared to the Tier 1 SEALs, they were playing college ball, says Harley. DEVGRU is the NFL. His DEVGRU experience was the major reason Harley continually reminded the men in his platoon during their 12-month workup that they were training for the real deal, despite the fact that it was peacetime. Having lost friends both in training and on missions, Harley knew the stakes were high. At the end of the day, this job has huge rewards, he told the platoon as they rested in the dirt after a particularly brutal patrol exercise. But you also pay a huge price for failure. Pro football players like to compare what they do to the warrior mentality, being at war, going to battle. Well, if you lose the Super Bowl, yeah, you're going to be pissed, you may shed a tear, you may go home and kick the dog. But the next morning you're going to wake up, eat breakfast with your wife and kids, and life goes on. The difference between Joe Quarterback and you is if you make a mistake and lose, you may be coming home in a body bag. You're not waking up the next morning. Your wife's not going to have a husband. Your kids aren't going to have a father. So when we're out here shooting blanks, you work hard and pray that if you make a mistake, it only costs you something, and you don't have to have another teammate pay that price for you. Early on in the workup, it became clear who had their sights set on DevGru. Adam was one of the first to take Harley aside, asking, "Chief, how do I get over there? What's my best route?" "Keep doing what you're doing," Harley said. "If you continue to be a top performer, the top 1%, you will get the opportunity to go over there. Be a sponge. Keep soaking up that knowledge like you're doing right now. I don't believe in luck, but I do believe in opportunity, preparedness, and hard work. You prepare yourself with hard work, and when that opportunity comes, take advantage of it." When training took place locally, Adam was home with Kelly and Nathan in Virginia Beach, about a third of the year-long workup. The other 8 months were spent at military bases across the United States and in the jungles of South America and the Caribbean.
"He'd come home after being away for a couple of weeks," said Kelly, "and he'd be bruised up from some fall, his hands calloused and cut up, his feet a mess. And within a few hours, a day tops of being home, he would tell me, 'Itty bitty, your job is so much harder than mine.'"
Although Adam avoided dirty diapers at all costs, Kelly knew he didn't take what she did for granted. Every minute he was home, he devoted to his family, making up for lost time and taking care of things around the house.
"He'd turn that work switch off," shares Kelly, "and turn that daddy and husband switch on."
At the end of the week, they would go to Atlantic Shores Baptist Church with Austin and his wife, Michelle, who had become Kelly's good friend. Kelly and Michelle volunteered their time in the church's nursery, a program that allowed parents to attend services and Bible study classes while their children were looked after. When Austin and Adam were home, they also helped in the nursery, playing with the babies.
"Austin and I were the newlyweds," says Michelle, "but Adam and Kelly were still on their honeymoon. In church, I'd look over and they'd be holding hands. He'd have the Bible with one hand and she'd turn the pages. We'd go over to watch a movie and they'd be on the couch planted side by side, cuddling."
At the end of each day they spent together, Kelly and Adam would read aloud from the Bible, a ritual they wanted to be a part of Nathan's life. They prayed for their families back in Arkansas and thanked God for the simple little life they were living together, one they hoped would someday return them to Arkansas. No matter how dark Adam's experiences in his hometown had been, they never blotted out the good memories he cherished. While taking long strolls with Nathan, he and Kelly talked about the home they'd have in Hot Springs, one with wood floors, a nice big kitchen, and a yard where Nathan and a sibling or three could grow up right, running and playing outside. If it was God's plan for them to return, that's where they would go after Adam served at least 10 years in the Navy. In the meantime, they would keep saving what they could from his paychecks and buy a house in Virginia Beach. Regardless of what they were doing separately or together,
"Adam still wrote me love notes and brought me flowers," says Kelly. "He never once missed my birthday or an anniversary. Even if he was gone, roses would show up or a card or something."
After Nathan's birthday, the boys geared up for winter warfare training, and the Browns were able to go out on a date, splurging with a restaurant dinner. It had been more than 3 years since they'd met, and
"I still felt that deep, almost nervous love I felt in the beginning," says Kelly. The military life pulls a lot of couples apart. But for me, it kept it new. Every time he'd leave, I couldn't get enough of him. I could never get enough of my Adam.
Adam Brown, a.k.a. Blade, was a funny guy. That's what Chief Harley kept hearing from his platoon. Not only the stories Adam told and what he said, but the funny things that happened to him. When you're out in a crummy situation, says Harley, and in our line of work that's most of the time, it's freezing cold or hot as sin, you're working your butt off, rucking all over the mountains, whatever. The guy you're with can either bring you down or boost you up. However he accomplishes it, if he can make you laugh in those dismal situations and still get the job done, he'll go far. Harley experienced Blade's celebrity firsthand when he paired up with Adam for winter warfare training in Virginia, as well as some one-on-one mentoring. They were dropped off in a field in the middle of nowhere one early February morning with loads approaching 90 pounds, a map, a compass, and a directive. Reach a specified location the following evening without discovery by the enemy force on patrol. Their route might include old logging roads, thickly vegetated wilderness, or steep, wooded mountains. Structures along the way, barns, sheds, hunters' cabins, were considered risky but usable shelter. Harley and Adam chose a route that took them over nearly 15 miles of brutal wilderness, during which rain turned to freezing rain and then, as night approached, to snow. A summer cabin that was as cold inside as out acted as a layup point where they could find shelter and sleep for a few hours.
Chief, said Adam, his teeth chattering, would it be tactically okay since it's after dark to build a small fire in here?
Hell yeah, Harley said. We've got wood, we've got a fireplace, we're hypothermic. Definitely light a fire. Bringing in a pile of wet wood, Adam built a small teepee in the fireplace, then asked what they should light it with. I didn't know Adam could be, a little clumsy, says Harley. And with frozen fingers and hands that weren't working so well from the cold, maybe I should have thought it through more. But I didn't. I just told him, just take some of that white gas we have for our stoves and throw it on there and then throw a match. It should light right up. Wearing his glove liners, Adam followed Harley's instructions and, woof, says Harley. It flamed right up, and Adam stepped back and was looking at the fire, his hands, at his sides, burning. Brown! Yelled Harley. Your gloves are on fire. Oh, damn, said Adam and clapped his hands together, but the gloves kept burning. He pulled them off and stomped the flames out. Adam, said Harley, your hands are still on fire. Eventually, Adam was able to smother the flames under his jacket.
Chief, I'm good, he said. Let me see your hands, Harley said, expecting to see second or third degree burns.
No, no, Chief, I'm good.
No, Adam, let me see your hands.
Adam relented, holding out his hands, which Harley was amazed to find were only slightly red. The flames had been residual gas burning off and never reached Adam's skin. During the week-long exercise, Harley accumulated story after story. Says Harley, Adam kept me entertained till the end of that miserable training, including the final night, when they had to follow a road in order to make their link-up point on time. So here's the deal, Harley told Adam. We'll walk down this road. If you see headlights coming, just step off the side about 10 or 15 feet, lie down, and they'll never see you. 15 minutes later, a car approached, and they shuffled off the road. As Harley flattened out on his stomach, he heard thud, thud, bang, crunch coming from Adam's direction. The car passed by, and Harley hurried over to where Adam had been, finding a drop-off into a massive drainage ditch lined with big, jagged rocks. He was lying on top of these rocks in a slump at the bottom, describes Harley, who for a second thought he was looking at a dead body. I called down, Brown, you okay? The body stirred and peered up at Harley.
Chief, Adam said, I fall a lot, but I don't get hurt.
Adam's task unit, golf and hotel platoons, headed to Mississippi at the beginning of September for their ORE. The thickly vegetated, hot, humid, jungle-like environment of Stennis was the setting for react-to-contact drills performed in a realistic exercise, complete with explosions going off, blanks being fired, and a motivated opposing force attempting to kill them. Between drills, the men of Golf Platoon were resting in some shade when Adam and teammate Mark Kramer noticed 9 or 10 guys from Hotel Platoon gathered in a circle. "What's going on?" Mark yelled over. "We got a pool going," one of the SEALs shouted back. $20 a man for whoever is crazy enough to set their balls on this fire ant nest for 30 seconds. A second later, Adam had his pants down to his ankles, says Austin. "Where is it?" he said. "I'll do it." "Whoa, wait, hold on a second," said another SEAL from Hotel. "There's some rules. Your balls have to be on the anthill for 30 seconds. They cannot lift up for 1 second. They have to be on it the entire time. Otherwise, you don't get the money." By now, both platoons had formed a large circle around the anthill. "Then, all the headshed, all the leaders came over," says Mark. "You'd think they'd say, 'This is stupid, don't do it.' Nope. They were all over it." "Okay, we'll put in $20 too," they said. Same with the corpsmen, the medics. No concerns about anaphylactic shock or anything. In naval special warfare, I found the corpsmen are the most sadistic of our bunch. With $600 in the pot from some 30 takers, Adam shuffled over and got into position, his bare behind hovering above the anthill, while a stopwatch was set and Christian stirred up the nest with a stick. As Adam squatted down slowly, the angry, swarming ants rose up to meet his anatomy, climbing on top of each other into a pyramid of defense. The second Adam touched the nest, 3 SEALs, including Mark, jumped on him and held him down. "Adam screamed like a little girl," recalls Christian. "I will never forget his expression," says Mark. "His face conveyed such acute agony, while everyone else was cheering." "Time!" shouted the SEAL holding the stopwatch, and Adam exploded off the nest, swatting himself furiously. "Get them off!" he shrieked. "Get them all off!" Looking Adam over, the medics counted almost 400 bites around his groin. "But it was hard to tell, because there were bites on top of bites," explains Mark. "Over the course of the day, there was massive swelling. In terms of fruit, think cantaloupes, small watermelons." All those stories, the burning gloves, the blade incident, the anthill, are all funny, and they all help us understand the man Adam was, says Chief Harley, who contributed his own $20 to the pot. But without a doubt, they should never, ever diminish his abilities, his personality as a warrior, as a SEAL. He could flip that switch from having this stuff happen, these funny moments, and the next minute, we would be downrange and be in harm's way, and he would be the ultimate professional operator, warrior, that you'd want. Adam had that rare ability to go from looking in the mirror and laughing at himself to being the cool-headed professional, the one person I'd choose to have beside me if I was surrounded by enemy and running out of ammunition. Adam was granted the rest of the day in the aid station by the corpsman, who propped his amply spread legs with pillows, iced his groin, put him on an IV, and shot him up with antihistamine to counteract the venom from the fire ants. The cash poured in. A couple of men who hadn't even been present gave Adam a 20 just because they'd heard the story. By September 9th, Adam felt good enough to waddle his way through the next evolution of training. On the night of September 10th, Golf Platoon was tasked with a combat search and rescue operation that took them into the morning hours of September 11th. The SEALs returned to their camp around 4 in the morning and were snoring within moments of hitting their bunks. "A plane just crashed into the World Trade Center," shouted the officer in charge as he ran into their tent a few hours later. In a flurry, Golf Platoon pulled on pants and boots and ran to the communications tent, where men were stacked like human bleachers, seated, kneeling, and standing around a small television set, watching in solemn disbelief. As horror upon horror was broadcast, there was shock, worry, tears, and anger in that tent, says Harley. But mainly, there was resolve. There wasn't a guy in there, Adam included, who didn't want a pound of flesh vengeance for what they were witnessing. They knew we were going to war, and more than anything, these guys wanted to be a part of it. During peacetime,
pre-9/11, it wasn't a popular decision to join the military to protect your country, says Mark Kramer. So my decision was sort of validated that day. Adam and I were going around trying to find coverage to call home, and he was right with me saying, "Get us out there. Let's get some payback." Adam had this intense love for his hometown and state, which is really what patriotism is. We had both been competitive in sports, talked about the frustration of watching a game from the sideline. So we were hoping and praying that the powers that be would let us go out and do what we were trained to do. Kelly, just back from an early morning trip to Walmart for diapers, was holding Nathan tight and watching the news when Adam finally got through.
"It's horrible," she said.
"I know," said Adam. "Pray for all those poor people who are suffering and scared. And you and Nathan stay home. Stay away from the base. Don't do anything. And I'll call when I can."
"What does this mean for you?" Kelly asked.
"I'm not certain," said Adam. "But I know now why God led me to do what I'm doing." He called her again that evening, and then once a day while he completed the final week of the ORE. During these talks, Kelly sensed a shift in Adam's being.
"Like clunk, he found the right gear," she says. "He had always been a proud American, but his patriotism definitely started defining him and who he was going to be. Those attacks really brought out the old Adam, before all the junk. He started to emerge again."
On the day golf and hotel platoons passed their final ORE drills and were officially ready to deploy, Chief Harley stood before his men. "They all wanted to go join the fight that they knew was being planned for Afghanistan," says Harley. "But their stated area of focus was South and Central America. That was where they were going for a 6-month deployment. So I told them, 'We don't know where the front lines are going to be in this war against terrorism, and as part of the big picture military, it's our job to cover our zone. Before last week, nobody was thinking about Afghanistan. And you know what? That's too bad. We aren't going to make that mistake and abandon the rest of the field. We're going to do our job. And it's an important job. And I know you will do your country and your families proud. Don't spend your time home bitching and moaning. Enjoy them, and this life and the freedoms we have. That's what you'll be fighting to protect soon enough. Mark my words, gentlemen." One of the first things Adam did when he returned to Virginia Beach was go to a jewelry store he and Kelly had walked by months before. She had stopped to admire a platinum and diamond necklace completely outside their budget, which Adam now paid for with a stack of 20s.
"I love it, Adam,"
Kelly said when he presented it to her as an early 26th birthday gift.
"I absolutely love it, but we can't afford this. We need to return it."
Adam then revealed the ant bites, starting at his torso and on down to the heart of the matter.
"There's a little money left over," he said. "We can put it in savings. I just want you to have the very best."
Adam's words and what came to be known as the ant necklace brought Kelly to tears.
"You are crazy," she told him as she hugged him. "I love you."
Not one to boast or brag, Kelly made an exception with the ant necklace and wore it proudly to dinner with their friends later that week. While Michelle, Heidi, and Becky admired it, their husbands recounted the event, starting with the dare, continuing with Christian stirring up the nest, and ending with Adam screaming like a little girl. Laughter soon turned to soft talk among the women, who shot glances at Christian, Paul, and Austin. "What's wrong?" Austin finally asked.
"I was just wondering why it was Adam and not you that took the dare,"
said Michelle, gesturing toward Kelly's necklace. "You would have wanted me to?" said Austin.
"Oh, yeah,"
said Heidi and Becky, nodding their agreement.
"Definitely."
Adam had expected to be somewhere in South or Central America for Christmas 2001. But an initiative known as Force 21, a massive reorganization of the United States military, had prompted the Navy's top brass to rethink the SEAL team's areas of focus, organizational structure,
and deployment schedules. Currently, an entire team consisting of 6 task units each focused on a geographic region. With the new plan, only 1 task unit on Team 4 would focus on South and Central America. Another task unit would cover Eastern Europe, another the Middle East and Central Asia, another Africa, and around the globe. In other words, each SEAL team could now cover the entire world. Adams' task unit was transferred to SEAL Team 2, also based at Little Creek. A highly unusual move since a SEAL would generally remain on the same numbered team for the duration of his career. Led by Chief Harley, Golf and Hotel platoons became Team 2's South and Central American task unit, a reorganization that postponed their deployment and added 6 more months of training. This meant that Janice and Larry Brown would have all their children and grandchildren, Nathan, Josie, Sean and Tina's little girl, 9 months younger than Nathan, and Maddie, Manda and Jeremy's 4-month-old baby girl, home for Christmas. Following family tradition, they went to church on Christmas Eve, and between visiting and eating, watched National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation and the outlaw Josie Wales. As usual, Sean and Adam ended up outside tossing a football back and forth, their breath hanging in the cold like smoke, chatting about the world, the Razorbacks, and fatherhood.
"I'd like to coach Nathan when he gets older," said Adam. "If it works out, God willing, we'll be back here in time for him to play ball for the Wolves."
Says Sean, "Adam started talking about moving back to Hot Springs early on as a SEAL. After 9/11, it was a blur, but I remember Adam saying that he was going to be fighting for us, for our way of life. Not us as in our family, but us as in America." Since October, Green Berets had been on the ground in Afghanistan, as well as some SEAL teams conducting reconnaissance missions in advance of 2 raids by Special Operations Forces. An airfield seizure in southern Afghanistan and a raid on one of Mullah Omar's compounds. The hunt for Osama bin Laden had begun, and while Adam assured his family that his first deployment would be to South America, he didn't hide his enthusiasm for getting into the fight in Afghanistan as soon as possible.
"I was in awe," says Manda, "because Adam was just Adam all over again, but in a different uniform. He was my hero as this crazy football player who loved Lake Hamilton High. Now he was a SEAL, and his team was our entire country. But he wasn't loud about it like he'd been before. He'd matured and was more quiet and humble, and that to me made him more powerful." "I was so proud," Janice says. "Think of those months after September 11th and all the American flags that were going up everywhere. We put one up, a big one. And when I saw a flag, I think, like any military mother, there was a little something extra. In fact, I was getting used to being proud of Adam instead of worrying about him. But 9/11 changed all that. And there I was worrying about him again, worried that he was going to war."
Larry felt the same conflicting emotions, but trusted that God had a plan and that Adam's part in it would be revealed. "He told me it was his calling," says Larry, who remembers that particular Christmas as the first time he'd discussed politics with his son. There was no need for debate. They were both on the same page. People were arguing back and forth about whether or not this was a holy war, and Adam and I couldn't figure out why, says Larry. "For the terrorists, it wasn't anything but a holy war, stated clearly by them. There was no doubt in our minds that they were waging a holy war. And Adam, as an American, as a warrior, and as a Christian, was not going to stand for it." Chapter 12. War. On April 3, 2002, Kelly drove Adam, now Petty Officer 2nd Class Brown, to the SEAL Team 2 compound at Little Creek to see him off on his first deployment. She watched as Adam held Nathan, now 2 years old, tightly against his chest, then tossed him in the air until the toddler was laughing.
"More, Daddy!"
Nathan shouted. "That's it, little buddy," Adam said, holding him in one arm while he wrapped his other around Kelly and kissed her nose and Nathan's
back and forth a few times. "Don't y'all grow up too much while I'm away," he told Nathan. He stooped to put his son in the car, then stepped back and threw him in the air one last time before strapping him into the seat. Adam gave Kelly a long hug and kiss and rubbed her stomach, which was barely showing a bump. The baby was due at the end of Adam's deployment. "You drive safely," he said to her, "and take care of our babies." While Adam flew south with his task unit toward Puerto Rico, Kelly and Nathan drove west to Arkansas where, in order to save money, they would split their time between her dad's house in Little Rock and the Browns' place in Hot Springs. "Once the water warms up," Adam had said to Kelly, "be sure you take Nathan swimming in Lake Hamilton." Nearly 6 months later, Adam flew into Hot Springs in time to witness his daughter, Savannah Nicole Brown, enter the world on September 24th, 2002. Tough in every other aspect of his life, Adam was overprotective of Kelly and downright squeamish when it came to childbirth.
"He attended to me," says Kelly. "Wouldn't let me lift things, like a box of detergent or whatever, and I'd say, 'How do you think I survived all these months you're away?' But I loved it, and how he'd get real quiet if I started talking about an ultrasound or something going on down there after I saw the gynecologist. He'd get this glazed look, like he did not want to be hearing this. There were times he thanked God that he was a male. When Savannah was born, he was there, and his eyes got a little teary, and he called her, 'My little baby,' right off the bat. And that stuck. She had his heart."
Adam brought Nathan into the hospital room to meet his baby sister later that day, and
"Nathan's little outfit did not match," says Kelly. "I bit my tongue, but inside I laughed, because when it came to stuff like that, Adam was a fish out of water. Put him in the jungle, the desert, mountains, ocean, whatever, and he'd maneuver his way to wherever he needed to be. But he'd get lost in the kid's sock drawer."
Everyone who came by Janice and Larry's to congratulate the family of four also wanted to hear about what Adam had done while deployed. He remained the consummate, quiet professional. "We just kind of did our thing," he said to Amanda's husband, Jeremy. One of the more exciting tasks he'd been assigned was assisting a sailor who'd been injured in the jungle, Adam said. But he wouldn't elaborate on the story, simply saying that he
helped with the medevac.
Even Kelly had a hard time getting the full story from her husband because
"he underplayed everything," she explains.
Months later, she learned that Adam had been awarded his third Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal for his actions. When she asked what the other two medals were for, he replied, "It was no big deal. Just doing my job." The commendation certificate, stuffed by Adam into a file in a desk drawer, read, "For professional achievement in the superior performance of his duties while serving as a member of a volunteer rescue team that provided medical assistance and comfort to an injured service member in the El Yunque rainforest from 5th to 6th May, 2002. Petty Officer Brown demonstrated great foresight by gathering needed medical supplies for the injured man. Displaying impressive courage and skill, he fought through 5 hours of treacherous river currents and vertical ascents. Once on the scene, he expertly assessed the situation and stabilized the patient. He continued to provide vigilant care throughout the night until evacuation was accomplished. Petty Officer Brown's professionalism and devotion to duty reflected great credit upon himself and were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service." More official praise thickened the U.S. Navy's file that archived Adam's enlisted service record. Evaluations that Adam had signed and Kelly never saw. These records documented Chief Harley's assessment that Adam's goofy, sometimes clumsy, laid-back demeanor belied his outstanding professional performance as a SEAL. In one of Adam's earliest performance evaluations while in Golf Platoon, Harley wrote, "Despite his limited experience, Petty Officer Brown's initiative and determination ensured 100% success in his platoon's department. A team player who was always willing to lend a hand where needed, even with an extensive workload,
Brown dedicated numerous late-night, weekend, and off-duty hours to assist his teammates in their departments. His exemplary performance has been a great influence on the junior members of the platoon. He scored outstanding on the most recent command inspection and SEAL PRT. Brown is on track to become a standout performer. He has unlimited potential and is dedicated to excellence. He is among the top of the second-class petty officers. A lieutenant who was the officer in charge during Adams' first deployment, which included joint training missions with host nation military in Puerto Rico, Suriname, and St. Croix, and counter-drug missions in Ecuador, described Adam in his next evaluation as a hard-charging SEAL operator. This warrior gives 100% the first time, every time. Providing a glimpse into what Adam's job entailed, the same lieutenant wrote, "His absolute dedication ensured 100% accountability and maintenance of over 300K of parachutes and associated mission essential equipment. While he served as lead instructor and established standard operating procedures for a vital week of interoperability training with the 160th Special Operations Air Regiment. Professionally instructed his 16-man platoon in every facet of helicopter insertion and extraction techniques with HH-60 and MH-47 helicopters. Served as the jump master during 40 high-risk air insertions and extractions, ensuring the safe control of over 75 SEALs in jump, rappel, fast rope, and helicopter cast operations, and 150 hours of live-fire demolition and field craft exercises. Brown implemented an innovative redirecting braking system that improved safety of rappel operations. This dedication to his teammates is his trademark." 2 weeks after Savannah was born, the Brown family returned to Virginia Beach, renting a house with a yard in a suburban neighborhood. While Adam began the 12 to 18-month workup for his second platoon, Kelly figured out the logistics of raising two children. In Afghanistan, the oppressive Taliban government that provided a safe haven to Osama bin Laden and his fellow al-Qaeda terrorists had surrendered 10 months earlier, on December 5, 2001, after just 2 months of war. While SEALs, Marines, and Army Rangers played a role in the beginning of Operation Enduring Freedom, it was fought predominantly by fewer than 100 Special Forces Green Berets, working with the CIA and a handful of Air Force combat air controllers. They joined forces with the Northern Alliance in the north of Afghanistan and a ragtag militia in the south led by a Pashtun tribal leader named Hamid Karzai, who would become the first president of Afghanistan. The swift victory against the Taliban regime then shifted to a counterinsurgency mission of fighting hardline Taliban insurgents and their allies, foreign jihadists pouring in from Pakistan and Iran. They sought to overthrow the fledgling Afghan government and oust the American-led coalition forces, whom they considered invaders and infidels. In addition to fighting these insurgents and jihadists and providing security for the newly formed Afghan government, the U.S. military's priority mission remained the manhunt for Osama bin Laden, the architect of the September 11th attacks on American soil. He was at the top of the list, followed by Mullah Muhammad Omar, the Taliban's founding father, and a laundry list of Taliban and terrorist leaders on the run in Afghanistan and around the globe. War planners realized almost immediately after the surrender of the Taliban that this was merely the beginning of combat operations in Afghanistan. Then, while Afghanistan's post-Taliban government and national police and army were still under construction, another war was being planned in the Middle East. U.S. intelligence, military leadership, and ultimately Commander-in-Chief and President George W. Bush deemed Iraq, more specifically Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, the gravest threat to national security. On March 17, 2003, President Bush demanded that Hussein and his sons Uday and Qusay surrender and leave Iraq within 48 hours. When that timeline was not met, the shock and awe bombing of Iraq began. 2 days later, about 45 minutes after the first bombs struck military targets outside Baghdad, President Bush addressed the nation and outlined the objectives of what would be a military invasion of Iraq. To disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities. That week, as the bombing campaign continued in Iraq, the Master Chiefs of SEAL Team 2 conducted an annual closed-door meeting in which they discussed, evaluated, and graded all the enlisted SEALs under their command. They ranked Adam Brown 5 out of 32 second-class petty officers. Adam's superior, another lieutenant, noted in his March 25th evaluation that Adam was a proven, tactically proficient operator, and that he had been selected as operator of the quarter due to his performance while deployed. Again, Adam was recognized as always the first to volunteer for the hard jobs and the last to leave, leads, mentors, and sets the example, the definition of a team player, advance to first class. Now, 6 months into his second platoon's workup, with war being waged on two fronts, Adam was virtually guaranteed deployment to a combat zone of a war he fervently believed in. Adam trusted our leadership, the checks and balances of our Constitution, and felt it was his duty to go where he was ordered to go, says Larry. Beyond that, he believed in his heart that what we were doing was the right thing. He educated himself so he'd have an informed opinion. Going after bin Laden was a no-brainer. The Taliban, the atrocities they committed, they needed to be removed. Their treatment of women and children was always a big deal for Adam. That got to him. And in Iraq, Adam remembered this photo of a Kurdish girl lying dead on the street, eyes open, after Saddam Hussein had gassed her whole town. All this argument about whether or not they had weapons of mass destruction, that was proof enough for Adam that they not only had them, but that Saddam Hussein had used them against his own people. He was evil. He was a bully, and to stand by and watch that and not do something about it was unacceptable to Adam. Says Kelly,
Adam believed in a spiritual battle between good and evil. Reading the Bible was part of his training, really, just like what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, with good people versus bad people. There was good and bad in a spiritual sense, and he wanted to be educated. So he read and read and read. Books, the classified reports he could get his hands on, and he watched the news. But more than anything, he couldn't wait to get over there and see for himself, try and do some good wherever he was.
One morning, Adam donned a fireman's hat and proceeded to exhibit what Chief Harley says was his ability to flip a switch and adapt to any situation. Wearing the bright red hat, he got down on his hands and knees and went to work. He slinked like a leopard, hopped like a rabbit, climbed onto a desk like a monkey, and with accompanying growls, clicks, and howls, he kept a dozen 2- and 3-year-olds riveted for the entire hour of Kelly and Michelle's Sunday school class.
He was a great big kid himself, says Kelly. I had a rule, no climbing on the desks, but I step out for a minute, and who's on the desk when I get back to the room? My 29-year-old husband.
Says Austin, the fact that Adam taught Sunday school really defines who he was. He'd play and act out the animals on Noah's Ark, and he'd tell me that was just the best way he felt he could praise the Lord. He was a human puppet for the kids. They loved Adam. Since Virginia Beach is a military town, each Sunday the congregation at Atlantic Shores Baptist Church prayed to God to watch over all who were serving. And almost every Sunday they also prayed for the families and souls of those killed the previous week. Michelle and Kelly never verbalized their own fears. But as each month of training brought their husbands closer to war, all it took was a glance during these all-too-frequent prayers for fallen warriors. If the wives' eyes met, they knew they were both experiencing the same sense of dread that only a military spouse can feel when a loved one is bound for war. While the wars waged on, Adam quietly continued to fight the personal battle that had begun the first time he'd smoked crack some 8 years earlier. His faith, family, and determination had kept him drug-free for almost 5 years. But his body and brain had been altered by the drug, and they would seek that pleasure forever. He had a one-beer limit, a tough maximum to adhere to in a community where, "If you don't go out drinking with the boys," says one SEAL, "you're not really one of the boys." It's the reality of the job. But there are exceptions, and Adam was one of them. Austin was another. Both solid operators who didn't get obliterated. They'd either limit themselves, or sometimes I'd look over and realize Austin was drinking water. They were a good influence, and most of the guys respected them for it. But Adam was human and would push his own self-imposed limits. On a Friday in late June, Adam and Kelly went out for a night of pizza and bowling with Christian, Paul, Austin, their wives, all of whom had been pregnant during the South American deployment, and children ranging in age from a few months to Nathan, the oldest at 3. The Browns returned home to a neighborhood get-together that Kelly encouraged Adam to attend while she put the kids to bed. After 2 hours, Kelly glanced out the window and saw that the lights were off at the neighbor's house. Then she realized that their car was gone. She called Adam's cell phone throughout the night, but he wouldn't pick up. And by the next morning, Kelly knew without a doubt what had happened. She was both crushed and furious. According to the neighbor, Adam had left with another neighbor to have a beer at a bar, and Kelly surmised that one beer led to another and another. Somewhere in there, with his willpower weakened by the alcohol, Adam had searched out the drug, or maybe somebody had offered it. Either way, he'd done it. Kelly asked Christian if he would go out and search for Adam. And together with Paul, the two SEALs spent all of Saturday driving around the worst neighborhoods of Norfolk and Portsmouth. "When we couldn't find him, I was devastated," says Christian. "Kelly was really troubled, and I felt like I was letting them both down. They were family."
"Thank you," Kelly told Christian that evening. "He'll be home tomorrow. This is the last time this is going to happen."
For Kelly, it bordered on miraculous that Adam had lasted this long without a relapse, because
it was the devil to him. Toward the end of his dark time, he'd come home and say, "I can't believe I let him get me. He paints this pretty picture, but I know it's wrong, and I don't want to lose y'all."
Kelly had spent that day and evening playing with the kids and praying, not overly concerned that something bad happened to Adam. No doubt he was hiding somewhere, afraid to return home because he was ashamed and angry at himself for giving in to the voice he had overpowered for so long. She believed this was another test, another hurdle put before her. And while God had never told her to leave Adam before, this time she felt guided to do just that.
"I wanted to shock him," she says.
Kelly filled Janice and Larry in on what was going on, receiving their full support to go forward with her plan. When Adam finally walked in the door Sunday morning, his head was hung low. Quietly, so Nathan, who was playing in the living room, could not hear, she said with all the venom she could muster,
"How dare you? You have a family. How dare you?"
He shook his head and appeared beat down and ashamed, says Kelly. He began to speak.
"No," she said. "I've heard it all before."
Studying his eyes, Kelly could tell that Adam was no longer under the influence of the drug. So she placed 9-month-old Savannah in his arms, picked up the suitcase she'd packed the night before, walked out the door, and drove away. While she completely trusted Adam with the children, it took all her willpower to leave her family and camp out for the next 24 hours in a room at the Navy Lodge at Little Creek. She read her Bible, watched television, and walked around the base for hours, listening to the ringing of her cell phone as its message box filled with Adam's apologies and promises. In addition to apologizing to Kelly, Adam was apologizing to God for being weak, and he prayed that Kelly would give him one more chance. He was also handling all the things Kelly usually did for their children, mixing formula for Savannah, changing diapers, preparing meals, bathing them. At bedtime, Adam held Savannah and sang to Nathan the happy song that he and Kelly had been lulling him to sleep with for almost a year. But tonight, for Adam, it was just plain sad. I love you. You love me. We're a happy family. Kelly returned home on Monday morning, having not answered even one of Adam's calls. She wanted him to understand what it felt like to have a spouse, the parent of your children, disappear.
"Please forgive me,"
he said as she passed him by and went straight to Nathan and Savannah and hugged them.
"I'm sorry."
"Get to work," Kelly replied. "We'll talk about a few things when you get home."
For the first time in his Navy career, Adam was late for his job that morning. In the afternoon, at Christian's request, he headed to a Village Inn restaurant. Christian was already seated when Adam showed up looking like a beat dog, you know, when a dog knows they did something wrong, just guilty. "I take this job seriously, and I knew he did too. But we all have weaknesses, and that makes people real. And controlling those weaknesses makes people strong."
"I really messed up," Adam said.
"I know," said Christian. And then he let Adam have it. "I am beyond disappointed. I am pissed. There is no room for that in this job. No way. We train at high levels, shooting real bullets. There is no room for error. I mean, seriously? We are Navy SEALs. I have to be able to trust you, man. We're going to war soon. You have to be the guy that's got my back when we go in and we're on target."
"I know," said Adam. "You're right."
"And you're letting your family down," Christian went on. "Kelly is an angel putting up with this. What the hell? I have to be able to trust that you've got my back, and if you're thinking about doing something else, thinking about doing crack and not protecting me or anybody when we're doing our job, I need to know where your mind is when we go into a room and we need to shoot and make decisions."
"That's it. I swear, I'm never going to do it again."
"All right then," said Christian. "I trust you. We're done here." That evening, Kelly informed Adam that there would be no more chances. The next time it happened, she and the kids would be gone for good.
"It was tough talk," says Kelly. "He believed it. I said it so he'd believe it. But I can't honestly say I really would have left him if he did it again. We prayed that night. We read the Bible, the verses on strength. And I told him he was letting God down, too."
A month and a half later, Team 2 was training in an MOUT, Military Operations on Urban Terrain, village on a base in Alabama. Defending the buildings within this setting were an opposing force of SEALs armed with M4 rifles and 9mm simulation rounds. Actual bullets with liquid paint-filled tips advertised as non-lethal for training purposes. Often referred to as paintballs on steroids, they are painful and can penetrate the skin. Protective gear for the neck and eyes is mandatory. Adam was moving up a stairway when he came under intense fire and was hit in the chest. He lifted his arms to signal that he was dead and began to walk down the steps to reset the assault by regrouping with his team to try again. At that instant, he turned. A final round aimed at his head slipped past his wraparound sunglasses and hit him in the right eye. He trotted outside the building where his team was waiting.
"Man, I got dinged," he said to Austin, then pulled off his glasses. "How does it look?"
The outer corner of his right eye to the center was covered with blue paint. Near the tear duct, it was blood red.
"Can you see out of it?" asked Austin.
"No, everything's blurry,"
Adam replied calmly. After being treated at a local hospital's emergency room, Adam called Kelly.
"Baby, I've got a problem," he said. "I'm okay, but I got shot in the eye with a sim round. Just grazed it. But I'm coming home. It'll be late. I'll get a ride."
From the way Adam downplayed it, Kelly assumed that his injury was probably a black eye. But when he came home, the bandage off because of pain, and his eye swollen to a squint.
"My heart nearly fell out of my chest," she says,
remembering the bloody tears that streamed down his cheek.
It was mangled. Just trashed.
Are you going to lose your eye?
She asked, hugging him tight.
I don't think so, he said. I'm scheduled for surgery in the morning.
At Portsmouth Naval Hospital, Adam and Kelly were told the bullet that had glanced off Adam's eyeball had all but destroyed his cornea, as well as damaged the lens, surrounding nerves, and muscles. Adam was now eligible for a medical discharge as a disabled veteran, at a level of disability that would pay a significant sum each month for the rest of his life. He refused to even consider the option.
One, I'm not disabled, and two, I'm not a veteran, he said. I haven't even fought for my country yet.
The doctors explained that he was still considered a veteran for having served in the military.
That didn't count as far as Adam was concerned, says Kelly. End of discussion. There wasn't an ounce of quit in him. What we did do was move out of our house into a smaller apartment to save a little money in case this was a career-ending injury.
For the next few months, which Adam spent alternating between doctor's appointments and his ongoing training cycles, the ophthalmology staff fought to restore the sight in his injured dominant eye. He could see shadows and detect movement peripherally, but beyond that, the eye was essentially blind. In addition, there was severe swelling of the eyeball, which the doctors had a difficult time getting under control.
The pressure was painful, says Kelly, but he wouldn't let on. I'd see him grimace when he didn't know I was looking.
Furthermore, Adam had come to believe that what appeared to be a freak accident
was actually God tapping him on the shoulder, letting him know he wasn't happy that Adam had succumbed to that voice, says Kelly. He was so depressed for a few weeks, and then he decided it was just another challenge, another lightning bolt God was throwing at him, to see if he'd get up or stay down.
The ongoing prescription was for steroid drops and an eye patch that delighted 3-year-old